Now, whether you agree with gun ownership or not, across the nation, Americans who own guns for reasons such as hunting on their own private land, target practice, home safety, and for some, a sidearm as part of having a federal license to carry. In some parts of the country, they are finding ammo to render one's weapon ineffective because they can't seem to find it. We're going to talk with John Lott about that and more. His work, More Guns, Less Crime on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. We'll take calls next hour with John Lott. We can talk with him now about one of his works, More Guns, Less Crime. John, it seems like everything you touch is controversial, the areas that you probe and study. How did you get involved originally writing a book and doing research on guns, less crime?
Well, it was definitely by accident. I had done a lot of work on crime. I'd been chief economist at the United States Sentencing Commission. I taught a lot of classes on crime. I'd written a lot of articles on crime, but they had never had anything to do with guns. They had been with white collar and corporate crime, reputational penalties that criminals face. A lot of those issues are, in fact, talked about in the book that we talked about last hour, the Freedomnomics book. But what had happened in 1993, I was teaching class on white collar and corporate crime at the Wharton Business School. And some students came up to me after class and they wondered if I could spend part of a lecture just talking about gun control. And I said, well, you know, I guess we have a little bit extra time. We could probably do a little bit on that. And I'd read some of the academic research on gun control and found it pretty wanting. But I figured, well, you know, maybe there's other stuff that's good out there. And if you're going to teach on something for a little bit, it kind of forces you to look through the literature. And I was just pretty shocked by how poorly done the existing research was. You'd have some of the larger studies would be looking at like 32 counties from across the United States. I don't know how you pick 32 counties. I mean, there's 3,140 counties, and it just seems very arbitrary to pick 32. And you would and I could go through for a couple hours and just talk about the problems with the work. But one of the reasons why you do research is either you have a new idea that nobody's had before or you think you can do a better job. And I usually try to do things that have kind of a twist or looking at a problem that nobody's thought of before. And so the gun stuff wasn't quite as interesting to me because it was something that wasn't new, but I thought I could do a better job. And that's one thing led to another on that. And in 96, after I had done my initial research on that, a reporter from USA Today named Dennis Couchon, who I had gotten to know when I was chief economist of the Sentencing Commission, he'd call me up every couple of years when he had some question about crime. And he called me up and he asked me some questions at the end. He said, well, what are you working on? And so I mentioned it to him. He said, well, you know, send me a copy of the paper. I'll look at it. And I sent it to him. And a couple of weeks later, he called me up, said it was really interesting, and that he'd probably get around to writing a story on it. Lo and behold, the next morning there was a story out, and just the interest in the work just exploded after that. It was really quite an amazing.
John, I'm a supporter in guns, as you know, in the Second Amendment. And, you know, this is a subject, of course, with most people. You either support guns or you don't. There's really no middle ground here at all. Very controversial. Those who do not support guns hate them. Those who like guns and support the use of guns for law-abiding citizens, of course, we know where they stand. How do you answer the criticism, because this is a tough one, when some kid or a wacko goes ballistic, either with an assault weapon or handguns, going into a school or a mall or somewhere, college, and he kills 10, 15, 20 people?
Right.
What do we say about that? First of all, have all those people legally owned guns? Have they stolen them from their parents? What are the situations with those cases?
Well, I mean, you have a whole range of issues on where they ended up getting the guns to begin with. But, you know, I start, before I go into kind of the weeds on those things, which are interesting questions, and just usually if I have a chance to talk to an audience, the first thing I'll do is just say, where do you get your information about guns? And the media has a huge impact on people.
Yes.
I mean, usually what I'll say to people is, you know, without thinking about it very hard, you can recall what seems like hundreds or thousands of stories about bad things that happen with guns. When was the last time you watched the national evening news and heard a story about somebody using a gun to protect themselves, protect somebody else. And usually people can't, and legitimately so, can't recall a story, or maybe one possible story that they can recall. And people, I think...
And it's not that it's not happening.
No, exactly right. No, that's exactly right. And, you know, people have a pretty good idea of the bad things that happen with guns. But, you know, and each year we have about 450,000 crimes that are committed with guns, according to surveys by the Department of Justice. They have to do surveys because not everybody reports a crime to the police. But those same types of surveys indicate that people use guns defensively about 2 million times a year. That means they use guns about 4 to 5 times more frequently each year to stop crime than they use them to commit crime. Now, one of the reasons why I don't think a lot of this gets news coverage is that the vast majority, 95% or so of the times that people use guns defensively, simply brandishing a gun is sufficient to go and cause the criminal to run away. And if you're a news reporter or an editor and you have two stories, in one case there's a dead body on the ground, sympathetic person like a victim, versus another story where you have a woman's brandished a gun, the would-be attackers run away, no shots are fired, no dead body on the ground, no crime actually committed, you're not even sure what crime would have been committed, I think any of us would choose the first story as being more newsworthy than the second. And that explains a huge percentage of the lack of coverage for those types of cases. But, you know, the type of situation that you're bringing up at the beginning of your question, in fact, shows that that type of benign explanation can't explain everything with regard to media coverage. Relatively few people know that about a quarter of the public school shootings in the United States have been stopped by citizens with guns before uniformed police were able to arrive. And the reason why they're unlikely to know that is only about 1% of the news stories on those attacks are mentioned when a citizen used a gun to stop the attack, that's what happened. If a police officer stops an attack, about 36% of those news stories will mention that the police officer used his gun to stop the attack. You know, you look at cases like the first of the public school shootings in Pearl, Mississippi in October 1997, in which two people were killed. You had an assistant principal there at the school, a former Marine, someone who had a permit to carry a concealed handgun, a guy named Joel Myrick. He would regularly carry his permanent concealed handgun with him on school property up until the end of 1995 when the Federal Safe School Zone Act was passed.
Okay.
After that, being a law-abiding citizen, he would lock his gun in his car, park it more than a quarter mile off school property in order to obey the 1,000-foot rule. When the attack started that day, he had to run a half mile to get his gun, a half mile back, and yet he was still able to hold the attacker at point-blank range for 5.5 minutes before the police were able to arrive. If you do what's called a nexus search, which is a computerized news search of news stories, you'll find in the 1 month after that attack, 687 separate news stories about the incident. Only 19 mentioned the assistant principal in any way. Only 13 of the 19 mentioned that the assistant principal was involved in some way with stopping the attack. And only 10 of the news stories mentioned that he actually used his gun to stop the attack. 8 of those were in local newspapers near where the attack had occurred. 2 of them were on national broadcast. One was on ABC World News Now, had a sentence on it at the 4 a.m. news broadcast. And then CNN had a story on it the day later on Early Prime, had about a sentence on it. But you see that time after time in terms of these cases. There was one case after the Appalachian Law School shooting about 6 years ago now, in which 3 people were killed, where I happened to be on a radio show, Larry Elder, I used to have a national show, and one of the two students who had used their guns to stop the attack was on, and he was telling Larry that he must have been interviewed by over 50 reporters after the attack had occurred, and being a law student, he used these computerized news searches just to see how he was quoted and what types of articles they wrote about him helping stop the attack. And he just couldn't find news stories mentioning it.
Jeez.
And I thought, you know, the kid's probably exaggerating a little bit. So I decided when I was writing my book, The Bias Against Guns, to go and call up the reporters and find out, one, did they know about the two students who had used their guns to stop the attack? And if so, why they decided to report the way they did. I called up 50 reporters. Every single one of them had heard the story about the students using their guns to stop the attack. Virtually all of them had either talked to either one or both of the students who had used their guns to stop the attack themselves, personally interviewing the students. And so I'd ask the reporters, then why is it that you didn't cover it? Maria Glad at the Washington Post gave me what was the typical answer to the extent I was able to get an answer. And she said she only had 913 words to write her story and simply didn't have enough space to go into that. You know, instead, she had written how the students had tackled the attacker and held them until police arrived, which was true, but it somehow gave the impression that the students had charged across an open field to an attacker who had a gun, which is not something I would normally recommend that people do, and actually maybe giving people the wrong impression about what they should do in that type of situation. And, you know, you think about what's newsworthy. What's more, you know, before I explained how kind of what's newsworthy would explain why many defensive gun uses aren't covered. In this case, I think it's the opposite. What's more likely to get readers to go and tell their neighbor, geez, you should have seen what I read in the newspaper? The fact that you say some students tackled the attacker or others once would say subdued or other similar terms, or to say the students used their guns to stop the attacker. Given the impression people have about how rare these things are, you would imagine the newsworthiness would have been greater if they had actually mentioned the students used their guns. You know, you mentioned assault weapons. You know, instead they would have, in many of these stories, a couple paragraphs or whatever talking about the types of weapons used in these attacks, and pretty much giving misinformation about what types of guns were actually used. And you know, just
because
like
they don't know, you know, John, they don't even understand. You know, I don't think most media folks know the difference between 9mm and 380.
No, I think you're right. And you know, just you talk to reporters and they think the civilian versions of AK-47s that we have here in the United States are essentially military weapons. They don't understand that the inside guts of a AK-47 that you go to a gun store and buy is the same as a deer hunting rifle. It's a semi-automatic, which means that each time you pull the trigger, one bullet comes out. That it's essentially has the same caliber bullet as a deer hunting rifle, fires with the same rapidity, does the same damage. But they use the term AK-47 as if it is the type of weapon that some military around the world would use, and it's not. And, you know, it's just that some people who own guns like guns that look on the outside like an AK-47.
John, is there an accurate feeling that government wants to confiscate everyone's guns? Because I see this on a lot of conspiracy websites and people I've interviewed. Is that true?
Well, I think there are many politicians who would like to do it. I don't think they're going to accomplish it right away. But I think a lot of these people have very long-term views on these things. They know what types of factors help explain whether somebody's going to own a gun. So if you grow up in a hunting family, for example, somebody's more likely to own a gun.
True.
And so I think the reason why many gun control groups help push with, like, animal rights groups for making people have to go through additional training and regulations to go and hunt is that they realize over the long term it's going to mean that there are going to be fewer gun owners around. And but you know, you look at the statements, you know, Nancy Pelosi just a couple weeks ago was talking about on the Today Show about registration for guns. You have Dianne Feinstein, who is on 60 Minutes just a couple weeks ago, saying that she knew that she couldn't push for assault weapons ban right now, but it was something that she was going to save for the right time in the next couple years. You have Barack Obama, when he goes down to Mexico, go and put out a statistic, which his own administration has already acknowledged is false, and that's that 90% of Mexican guns come from the United States. And you have to wonder why people don't trust them or think that they have some ulterior motive. They're willing to go so far to demonize guns and gun owners to use a statistic that's false. It's difficult to go and trust them. And you see you know, I don't think it's by accident that you have ABC and many other media outlets going and attacking guns right now. ABC just had an amazing news special a few weeks ago about the supposed futility about people carrying concealed handguns to stop the types of attacks that you're talking about. They didn't go and look at any actual cases. I mean, I could go and give you lots of cases.
Well, you were one of the best. As a matter of fact, it was your book, More Guns, Less Crime, that helped get Missouri to pass, finally, its concealed weapons law.
Well, thanks. But the, they had this amazing program where they set up this experiment where they give a student a gun to sit in the class, and they say, well, you're just going through some basic training right now. Later in the day, you'll have to use it. They'd have a trained firearms expert, someone who teaches strategy and tactics and expert marksmanship to police, pretend to be the attacker, come into the room, you'd fire two shots at the instructor there, and then start firing at the class. But the thing is, he knew which student had the gun in the class. Within 2 seconds, between 1.5 and 2 seconds after he enters the room, he's firing directly at the single student in the class that has a gun. That's not a real-world scenario. The thing is, not only aren't they experts, the people who engage in these attacks, but even more importantly, there's a huge benefit to having a concealed handgun. When you have 50 people in the room, the attacker doesn't know which person can defend themselves. And in the confusion with people running around and everything, it's very difficult for the attacker to pick out which individual might be able to defend themselves or which individuals might be able to defend themselves and others in the room there. And
it is true that in states that have passed concealed weapons laws, crime has gone down. Is that not correct?
That's right. But not only do you see crime going down generally, but the types of things, these multiple victim public shootings, have plummeted. In states that pass these rules, you see about a 60% drop in the rate at which these multiple victim public shootings occur. For murders, generally, you'll see about 1.5%, 2% drop for each additional year that the laws are in effect. But the reason why you see such a huge impact for these multiple victim public shootings is essentially a simple point with regard to crime, and that is the greater the deterrence, the greater the drop that you have in crime. If I have 50 people in a room, and even if there's only a 3 or 4 or 5% chance that any one individual has a permanent concealed handgun, the probability that at least someone there is going to be able to stop the attack is essentially 100%. And the greater, as I say, the greater the probability, the more the reduction. And Bill Landis at the University of Chicago and I looked at all the multiple victim public shootings in the United States from 1977 through 1999. And the big thing that determines how many people get killed or injured in these attacks is the amount of time that elapses between when the attack starts and when someone's able to arrive on the scene with the gun. It's amazing how few times the gun even has to be fired. Time after time, simply pointing the gun at the attacker is enough to get him to stop the attack. And that's one of the big differences with this firearms expert that was there. You know, obviously, he knew he wasn't going to be fired back at, with a real bullet, so there was no cost for him going on. But, you know, the normal types of law enforcement, I have to say, my research, if it convinces me of one thing, is how important police are. I think they're the single most important factor for reducing crime.
Well, and most police officers, as you know, John, I'm talking about the rank and file now, not the chiefs, they support concealed weapons by citizens.
No, I agree completely. And the reason why they do, even though they know how important they are in reducing crime, they know the benefits to themselves owning guns, and they also realize how they can't get there all the time. They almost always arrive on the crime scene after the crime's already occurred. And the question is, what do you advise someone to do when they're having to confront a criminal, or in the case of your question, these multiple victim public shootings by themselves, and simply telling people to behave passively, and the police would never behave passively
Not
if they
all.
Ran into a criminal.
Hey, John, let's talk about the national ammunition shortage when we come back. Well, why is there a national ammunition shortage? Some say it is a combination of factors, including fear and changes in gun laws, the economy, a boost in the number of armed police officers who are using more and more ammunition, and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan contributing to what is becoming a nationwide shortage. And here we have John Lott. John, all of the above and maybe some more? Why are people having trouble finding ammo, and then those that do find it buy it all up?
Right. Well, I think it is all the above. I think probably the dominant one is the first one you mentioned there, that people are afraid. And when you have politicians making the types of statements that I mentioned earlier about talking about various types of bans or registration, I can understand why people have the fears that they do. I think they're a little bit overblown. I don't think a lot of the worst things that people are afraid of are going to happen right now. But they may happen one day, but they're not going to happen in the near future. And I assume one of the things that happens is that manufacturers don't really ramp up production because they think that demand won't stay high at this level for a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one reason why you can get people start talking about assault weapons ban. I mean, it's already hard to buy certain types of so-called assault weapons. And that may be more difficult if the legislation comes forward. But they're not going to go and start building more factories to produce that because they know once the ban goes into effect, they're not going to be able to sell those types of guns anymore. And so why waste all those expenditures on putting together new machines to do that?
A company in Georgia called Georgia Arms, which reloads and sells about 2 million spent rounds each week, the owner said, if I didn't have another order beyond today, it would take me 6 months to catch up. It's amazing. I mean, that's the business to go into nowadays, huh?
Right. Well, the problem is, though, I mean, you can make a lot of money if you already have everything all set up.
Ready to go, yeah.
Right. But you're not going to think that this is going to continue for years. I mean, maybe you will keep on going for another 6 months or what have you. But I think it's hard to believe that it's going to go on much more than another year.
John, I know a doctor in St. Louis. He's got one or two guns. He bought 6,000 rounds.
Right.
What are you going to do with that?
Well, I mean, anybody who's gone target shooting knows that it's pretty easy to go through a couple hundred rounds without trying too hard. And, so he just doesn't have to go to the store. We've talked about kind of the lack of understanding.
He is the store.
Yeah. Well, we've talked about the lack of understanding of the media on some of these things, and you'll see breathless news reports talking about somebody having hundreds of rounds or... And you just know that there, maybe 1,000 rounds or, 6,000 may be high, but it's not something that's completely ridiculous for somebody to go and have. If I, why you have to go to the store that often? So I go and buy one big, bulk purchase, store it in the basement to wherever I'm going to be storing it. And then I just go and use it over time as I go and do target practice shooting. But it's, it may be high, but it doesn't bother me at all. But of course, it feeds into your earlier question about why, if a lot of people are doing that, why the prices go up so much right now. And it's just not the federal legislation. You have rules going forward in California and New York and other states with this micro stamping of ammunition that would go and raise the price of ammunition, make it much more costly. So it's not necessarily a bad investment. Also, for somebody who think in those types of states, who plan on shooting for a number of years.
Absolutely, we're going to take calls with John Lott next hour. Then I'll have open lines during the last hour of the program. John, tell me about the illegal weapon trade. Where are criminals, for example? Where do they get these unregistered guns? Where are they coming from?
Right. Well, I think one thing people have to understand to begin with is just how much crime is drug gang related in the United States.
Huge.
It is huge. There was a major study that came out from the Department of Justice a couple months ago, and it got very little coverage. It indicated that about 80% of violent crime in the United States was drug gang related.
I've advocated on this show to legalize drugs and control it. Give it out to people. If somebody's got an addiction, you give it to them. Try to get them help, of course, medical help. But right. I mean, rather than for them to go rob somebody or some family, they can go into a place and get it.
Right. No, I mean, there's strong arguments to be made for what you're saying. I might temper it a little bit by saying that you're going to have more drug use than you have right now. But on the other hand, you wouldn't have the type of carnage that you see in major urban areas. I don't think most people appreciate it. If you look at murders across the United States, 50% of the counties have zero murders in any given year. 25% of the counties have one single murder. You have about 75% of the murders in the United States concentrated in just 3% of the counties. And if you live in a city like you live in Los Angeles, every once in a while, newspapers will go and print a map that will go and show you where the murders are located in the city.
I have the distinction of living in Detroit, St. Louis, and Los Angeles at any given time, and these are all huge murder capital areas.
Right. But even within those areas, it's very small areas within those cities that most of the murders occur.
True.
And basically...
And we're not talking about the serial killer or the random shooting. You're talking about, by and large, day-to-day murders.
Right. And you're talking about drug gangs often or drug gang-related crime that's occurring. And I think one of the reasons why murder rates fell during the 90s was because there was less profit to be made in selling drugs. That at the end of the 80s and the beginning of the 90s, there was a cutback, or at the beginning of the 90s and during the beginning of the Clinton administration, there was a cutback in drug interdiction efforts that we had been using after the Cold War ended. We had started using our military to go and interdict drugs coming into this country. It was basically only the very largest drug cartels that could go and ship in large quantities of drugs into the United States. When that ended, you had drugs from a lot more different sources coming in. And not only did the price go down, but because of the increased competition, because you had more sources, the profits from selling the drugs also declined. And that has simply reduced the incentives for gangs and drug groups to go and fight against each other in order to control drug turf. One thing people probably don't know is that the highest year that we've had murder, highest murder rate we've ever had in the United States was 1933. That was the last year of Prohibition. You look at, in the 2 years after Prohibition ended, the murder rate in the United States fell by about 60%. You know, just like now with drug gangs, back then in Prohibition, if the mob at that time tried to take over, one mob group tried to take over the alcohol turf from another area. It's not like they go and call up the police and say, this guy's invading our area, can you get him to leave? They have to set up their own militaries, essentially, in order to defend their valuable property. But to go and bring it back to your original question about the source of the guns, you know, you look around the world, and you find the same type of pattern in terms of murders overwhelmingly being related to drug gangs.
Yeah.
When countries like Britain ban guns, you see an increase in crime. And they just can't, but what they also find is that it's almost impossible for them to stop guns from coming in, even though handguns are illegal in the country, because the drug gangs that they have can not only bring in the illegal drugs, but they can bring in the guns that they use to protect the illegal drugs.
Absolutely. And the law-abiding citizen there can't do anything.
Yeah, they're the ones who obey the rules. They're the ones who are disarmed. And that's, you know, one thing I've found is that every place that I've studied that's banned guns, whether it's not just been the United States, like D.C. and Chicago, but countries around the world, you see increases in murder rates and violent crimes every single time after a gun ban's gone into effect. You at least think that the gun ban advocates could point to one country. And, you know, if you ever have somebody on the show, just ask them, identify one place where a ban's gone into effect and murders have gone down. And they can't do it.
Now, tell me about Australia, because they banned guns there, didn't they? Not?
Well, they didn't completely ban guns. They banned about 60% of the types of guns that had been sold down there. And there was an increase in violent crimes there afterwards for over a decade after the rules went into effect. And you were alluding to this a minute ago. The real question you have to ask with gun control laws generally is who's most likely to obey them. And what we find is that if it's the law-abiding good citizens who obey the laws, then what you do is you disarm them relative to the criminals. and you make it so that the criminals have less to worry about. Well, one simple example comparing the United States and Britain. Britain has about twice the burglary rate that we have here in the United States. But not only that, but almost 60% of the time that burglary occurs in Britain, it occurs while the residents are in the dwelling.
Jeez.
In the United States, it's about 13%.
So they don't even care because they know that the Brit doesn't have a gun.
That's exactly right. When they do surveys of burglars in the United States who are in jail, and they ask them, how long do you spend casing a house before you break in? American burglars report that they spend about twice as long as their British counterparts. And when they are asked why, they give the exact reason that you just gave. And that is, they're worried about getting shot. That's not a concern that their British counterparts have.
Well, that's because they know that, you know, the chances are pretty high that that person in Great Britain will not have a gun. He might have a knife, but he won't have a gun. But right. the person who breaks into the house probably has the gun.
Yeah. You know, even in the United States, where we've seen laws passed that go and require that people have to lock up their guns, you see two things that happen. You see that criminals become more emboldened to attack people in their homes when they're there. They don't spend as much time casing a house as they did previously. And they're more successful in harming the people in the home than they were previously. So we don't have the British disease in the sense anywhere nearly as bad as the British do, but you can see when states try to pass these types of gun lock laws, which is something that's high on President Obama's agenda to try to pass, you see that criminals respond there. They are more likely to commit crimes and people are more likely to get harmed.
Are you one of the few economists out there that stick your neck out in support of guns?
Yeah,
that's what I mean,
it's I can't tell you how many friends of mine in academia that have just told me that, you know, they might have done some research on this area, but, you know, they just see kind of what one has to put up with in terms of, you know, just not just academia generally. But I mean, academia is a fairly liberal place. And, you know, it's just creates an interesting life for some of the things you have to do. I mean, I can give you stories. When I was at University of Chicago, for example, I had Mayor Daley call up the president of Hugo Sonnenschein, president of the University of Chicago, and basically go through a whole list of things that the city wanted to do with the school and the projects that they wanted to work on and the great future that they could have. And then he said that my continued presence at the University of Chicago was going to do, quote, irreparable damage to the relationship between the city and the school there. And, you know, needless to say, I was gone at the end of that school year. And, you know, and when I was at Yale, I had a couple of U.S. senators and a state attorney general call up and complain to the dean about me. And, you know, in Daley's case, I mean, obviously he was leading the suits against the gun makers that were there. And, you know, he was upset by opinion pieces that I had written criticizing lawsuits in both the Chicago Tribune and the Wall Street Journal. And, you run into those types of things. I think if I had been on the liberal side of those types of issues, I don't think administrators at different schools would have put up with that.
No.
I think they would have said, you know, this is academic freedom of speech, and they would have, but, you know, those are the types of things that happen.
I have heard that police departments are concerned that they, too, could run out of ammo. Some of them are stockpiling.
Right. Well, I mean, they have budget issues that are there. They only have so much money to spend on different things. And if the price of ammunition goes up, you know, they may do less target practice shooting than they would have done otherwise, which has its own costs and issues involved. But, you know, they only have so much money. I mean, you either have fewer police or you have fewer staff or you have to go and buy less ammunition.
Well, where does it all end then, John? What's going to happen? Look into your crystal ball 3, 4, 5 years out.
Well, I mean, there are lots of things that the Obama administration can do beyond just new laws that are get passed. And, And I think you see this not only in the debate, claims about facts that we've already talked about, but that go and try to demonize gun owners and try to help push in many different ways for gun control. But that's just the beginning of what I think is going to happen. I think you look what happened during the Clinton administration. They were coming out with a new quote-unquote study every 6 months about the benefits of the Brady Act or the assault weapons ban. And essentially what they would do is they'd say, look, the assault weapons ban went into effect in 94. Violent crime has fallen since 94. Therefore, the assault weapons ban is responsible for the drop. It was nothing more than a 3 or 4 page press release, maybe sometimes 6 pages. It wasn't really what you would call a study, but the New York Times and USA Today would have front page stories on it saying new government study claims that crime has fallen. Of course, crime had been falling from 91. And of course, even the academic studies that the Clinton administration funded, there's not one single refereed academic study that's found that either the assault weapons ban or the Brady Act have reduced any type of violent crime rate. And yet, those studies kept on coming out, you know, from kind of the political people or the not academic types at the Justice Department. And I assume we're going to be seeing the same things here. It always kind of amazes me how when Republicans are there, they really don't care about research that's done. In fact, when Bush took over, the person who was the head of the Bureau of Justice Statistics and the person who was head of the National Institute of Justice were both Democrats. And the person who was head of the Bureau of Justice Statistics had been deputy director under the Clinton administration. And they just didn't seem to care about having what I would regard as higher quality research that was there. And I think Obama and Clinton both understand how research and at least the media coverage of that later on affects the debate. And I think you're going to run into more of that, too. And I think it may not be now in the next couple of years, but I think you're going to see, you know, the assault weapons ban. You're going to see pushes for registration. You know, Pelosi, as I mentioned just a couple of weeks ago, was pushing for registration of guns in the United States. The claim is that if you register guns, it can help solve crime. And the notion is that if a gun is left at a crime scene and it's registered to the person who committed the crime, you can go and trace it back. The problem is, one, guns are very rarely left at the crime scene. When they are left at the crime scene, it's because either the criminal has been either seriously injured or killed.
Right.
So you're going to catch them anyway. And when they are left at the crime scene, they're virtually never registered. And when they are registered, the few times, they're not registered to the person who committed the crime. And so you look at Canada, for example. They've had licensing and registration of handguns since the 1930s. Just a couple of years ago, the government came out and noted that there's only 3 crimes that had been committed with handguns that registration had helped solve. And even in 2 of those 3 cases, it was debatable. You look at Hawaii, which has had registration of guns for 50 years. A couple of years ago, the Honolulu police noted that they could not identify 1 single crime that they had been able to solve as a result of registration. And, you know, that's real money. Nice. I mean, we were talking a minute ago about, you know, the problems with police not having enough money maybe to go and buy ammunition. They're being forced in many of these places to waste valuable police resources on these laws that may politically have something for politicians to make hay of, but are just a waste of money. And the long gun registration that they've had in Canada now, they spent something like $2 billion Canadian on it. They could go and hire 30,000 police
instantly. Let's take some phone calls when we come back, John Lott.